This is Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined.
Got him in the white trunks. He heard it.
Beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he scores the top.
Wow.
And here comes a mention. And it's all over. It's
nice.
All over. First round knockout.
Big
he's out. Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Demetrius Johnson made history on Saturday night in Kansas City as he tied Anderson Silva for the UFC record for consecutive successful title defenses as he became the first person to submit Wilson Hayes as he used an armbar to retain the UFC flyweight title in the third round. And we are going to recap what happened on Saturday night at UFC on Fox 24 on this episode of the MMA Report post-fight podcast on Radio Influence. Along with recapping UFC on Fox 24, we're going to recap Bellator 177 and everything else that happened this weekend in MMA. Now, before I bring in Daniel Galvan to discuss these fights, I want to let you know about our sponsor, Fight TV. Fight is your number one source for MMA boxing and pro wrestling video. It's your gateway to everything fighting, MMA wrestling, boxing, and more, live on your phone or TV. Live stream free and premium MMA, pro wrestling, and boxing. Download Fight today by going to fight.tv/radioinfluence/. Once again, that is fight.tv/radioinfluence/. And that link is available on radioinfluence.com. Of course, you can always listen to the MMA Report pre-fight and post-fight shows on radioinfluence.com. Also available on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play. Just search the MMA Report so you can hear all the pre-fight and post-fight shows. Daniel, how's it going, man?
It's going good, Jason. I'm a little tired. I watched the Ryzen card last night, but I tell you what, I really, really am happy today because it's been a while since we've done one of these post-fight shows where I feel really pumped up to talk about the show we just watched. And I really do think last night's UFC on Fox was just a really enjoyable card to watch start to bottom. A little sleepy towards the end, but that's just my body being incredibly weak, but I really, really enjoyed the sport last night. How about you, man?
Oh, I enjoyed the card as well. Just like yourself, I was getting tired. I guess that's probably more about the fact of waking up at 5:30 in the morning on a Saturday morning. you know, once it gets about till about 9:30, you start to kind of want to get tired down. But I really enjoyed these fights, top to bottom. A lot of great topics here for the post fight podcast. You know, we'll get into Mike England later on and why the hell he was refereeing those fights and trying to get Nathan Coy killed, apparently. But let's start off by talking about the pound-for-pound king, Demetrius Johnson, once again, defending successfully the UFC flyweight title. I talked about it on the pre-fight show where I'd be interested if this fight hit to the ground and how well would Wilson do on his back. And man, I did not necessarily see a armbar submission. And first off, kudos for Demetrius Johnson just for going for it. I don't know how many fighters who are fighting Wilson Hayes would go for a move like that, because if you're unable to lock that in, you're going to lose a great position, and all of a sudden your opponent's going to be in a great position. But man, Demetrius Johnson, what more can you say about this guy?
Well, you can say that after 11 title defenses, Demetrius Johnson is finally getting over with the crowd. It took a while. It really did take a while. And it really helps that he's been on TV time and again. But I do feel like, especially with this fight, while it may not do a big rating, I'm pretty positive it won't. I mean, it was going head-to-head with the NBA playoffs the first day of that and the NHL. While it won't do a big rating, I do think you're going to see a lot of people get up and excited for the next Demetrius Johnson fight. I don't know why I get this sense in my mind, but I do get the sense that when you start throwing around, they're doing a great job of marketing around the fact that he's breaking history and he's becoming more and more of just maybe the greatest fighter of all time. That narrative is starting to work there, and I really did think we're going to see a turn here, because I think the early narrative from just a pure business standpoint regarding Demetrius Johnson was he just wasn't necessarily getting over with the casual fan, but I think that's definitely changing. And well, duh, obviously, if you are that dominant for that long period of time and you consistently come out and improve and improve and improve, you're going to get Over. And clearly DJ is over. And I thought the theme of this fight, the co-main event, the Whitaker victory, is you had three fighters who are incredibly, incredibly composed and confident in their skill level and willing to risk things in order to kind of defeat their opponent and secure the win. And clearly that's what took place there. I mean, Demetrius Johnson's win over Wilson Hayes, just another highlight reel.
Go back to October of 2011. Demetrius Johnson versus Dominic Cruz. Fast forward now to April of 2017, how much of a different place both those fighters are. If you had said after that night in 2017, the pound-for-pound king is going to be either A, Dominic Cruz, or B, Demetrius Johnson, I think everyone would have picked Dominic Cruz.
Yeah. I think the only reservation you have is like, well, Dominic may have a history of injuries, but that's just a slight reservation you make before you put all your money on Dom Cruz getting that mantle. I don't know when it was that the flip switched for Demetrius Johnson being recognized as clearly just a dominant champ. Maybe it was the second fight with Joseph Benavidez where he knocked him out in just about 2 minutes. Maybe it was the win over Moraga prior to that or the John Dodson win. I'm not super sure, but it felt like the transition did happen very quickly. And, you know, he certainly put himself in the conversation, and there was a point in time where I think our eyes would roll when Dana White would talk about Demetrius Johnson being the best pound-for-pound fighter or one of the best fighters of all time, but the eyes aren't rolling now. He's clearly a part of that discussion, and we're going to continue to have that discussion as he continues his career because it's clear he's not near over. He continues to improve, continues to do unique things. But as it stands today, I mean, Demetrius Johnson is obviously a part of that mix when you look back of not only the best fighters today, but the best fighters of all time. He's certainly in that mix. I don't know if he's number one quite yet. I feel like, I don't know, I really like seeing these guys retire first before we have this discussion.
Yeah.
But for a sport that's so young, we don't really have that luxury, do we?
No, we don't have that luxury. And the crazy thing is that Demetrius Johnson is only 30 years old. And, you know, we got that question about, you know, greatest of all time. And this comes from at B. Abraham 1988 saying, why are people forgetting about John Jones? Clearly, he's the GOAT based on opponents and his record. And I think a lot of the reasons people forget about John Jones is we haven't seen John Jones in a long time. Yes, we saw him last year at UFC 197, but because of all of his issues, he's kind of, in a way, become a little bit of a forgotten guy. However, if you happen to look at John Jones's Twitter yesterday, I mean, can we just go ahead and just book John Jones, Daniel Cormier? Can we just get this fight going as quickly as possible?
Yeah, I mean, apparently, you brought the news to me. The UFC just does not like promoting suspended fighters, which I tell you what, that makes sense. That really does. I can't criticize them for not promoting a suspended fighter, but clearly, that while that isn't known yet, that has to be the direction this company goes in, because this company needs fights that matter, simply put. That's the reason why I'm going to continue to criticize the Bisping matchmaking. But at the end of the day, I totally understand why you do Bisping GSP. Hypothetically, if that fight is actually made. But John Jones, Cormier, it needs to happen. It's a fight that's been set up for years upon years, and it's not even an original matchup. It's a rematch. I can't wait to see it happen. And what's crazy, and John Jones is going to be a big what if, because this guy, in the prime of his career, has fought once a year, 2014, 2015, 2016. He's still 29 years old, and we still consider him probably the greatest of all time. That speaks a lot to how great he is, that he's able to get suspended constantly and still be recognized that way. And that's probably a reason why DJ is in the conversation with him. But I think what DJ has over John Jones is just a more elite level skill level at every facet of the game. Whereas a John Jones, obviously elite in several facets, but it does simply feel like if you told Demetrius Johnson he could only strike with a striker, he could only wrestle with a wrestler, he could only grapple with a grappler, he would win all three fights. So that's the reason why John Jones has a more impressive track record. And again, it's worth reminding yourself that he is still actually younger than Demetrius Johnson.
And for people who had not seen these tweets, what set it off was there was a fan that sent a tweet to Daniel Cormier that said, quote, I hope John Jones knocks you out. And then Cormier's response was, quote, he won't. He doesn't have that ability. He never has. Even when he juiced his way to deadlifting 600 pounds, he couldn't knock out Ovince. And, of course, John's response was, quote, "Do you really think I took steroids, or is that just another thing you tell yourself to sleep better after I made you forever my bitch?" And right when I saw that tweet, I'm like, oh, man. I just love this version of John Jones. I just love this version. I mean, the guy is, and, look, we're probably looking August, September of a likelihood of that fight happening. And I do want to get into what you said about Michael Bisping when we talk about Robert Whittaker later on. But, I mean, Demetrius Johnson, I mean, I think now the question becomes is what's next? And, you know, when you look at the current UFC flyweight rankings, one thing you realize is how many of those guys that Demetrius has already defeated, but one of the guys that he's not fought yet and is currently ranked fourth, the fourth title challenger is Ray Borg. Now, Ray Borg has had, you know, the failed weight problems, which I think that's kind of got to go into a little bit of thought process of maybe do you want to see Ray Borg have another fight, prove he can make, you know, 125 pounds and then give him a title shot or go ahead now. You know, people are talking, you know, Cody Garbrandt is talking about this quote unquote super fight, but I agree with Dana White. Like, Cody needs to defend that title a couple times before we start talking about a super fight. And also, like, I almost feel like Cody's talking more about Demetrius Johnson than he is TJ Dillashaw. It's like, you do realize you're fighting TJ Dillashaw next, right?
Yeah, that's a concern. He hasn't defended the title, and he's taking on, like, a killer, a straight killer. That's a tough one because we really want to see – I mean, it should be – it's kind of funny because DJ should be the one calling for the super fight. No, I mean, he should be the one that's frustrated at the lack of challengers. But actually, I mean, at the end of the day, moving back up to a weight class where you're going to be significantly smaller isn't super compelling. And it's going to require, like DJ says, seven figures, which you can't blame him for asking mm-hmm. for that. What's next? It's much like, just line them up. You're not going to market a flyweight title match on a pay-per-view that does well. If that's your main event, that's just the lay of the land, Jason. So the flyweight division is essentially Demetrius Johnson beats people up. And that's just what you got to do. You analyze who's the guy that has the best credentials and you keep a preference for guys that haven't actually fought DJ yet. And so a guy like Ray Borg is up there. But yeah, man, you look at the flyweight rankings 1 through 15, it is absolutely startling what they all have in common, a loss to Demetrius Johnson. I really want to know what the over-under is for the amount of fights Benavidez is going to have to win in order to get another title shot. I think it's 17, but I actually can't wait for that fight to happen again because I really love the narrative of these guys who constantly fight the same guy and just can't beat them, but they keep on going after it. I actually secretly enjoy it, but those guys, in order for me to enjoy that narrative, they have to actually like go above and beyond to get that third fight.
You know, one of the things I hated about last night's broadcast is, and Fox, I mean, look, I think Dominic Cruz is one of the best analysts they have.
Yes.
But can we not have fighter analysts on that are training partners with one of the fighters? It's like, wow, shocking that Dominic Cruz picked Wilson Heist to win. Shocking. No one saw that one coming.
I actually thought you were going a different direction. I kind of agree with that. I do.
Because it's not – they're not going to – they're not – it's a disservice to the viewer because they are – obviously, you know they're going to pick their teammate. And I just – I feel like that Fox should make sure that they don't put an analyst in that position where – you know, they're not going to be critical of their teammate.
Yeah, he's not going to crap on Wilson. I thought you were going to say you were annoyed. Maybe I'm the only one that gets annoyed by this. But when they bring in Cormier and Dominic Cruz for 1 minute of a fight to do commentary, that actually grinds my gears. I don't know why. I don't like it. I don't like it when they just have the two. Like, it ruins the flow of the commentary. And maybe this is me being totally anal. But, like, in the first minute of the second round of the Whittaker-Jacare fight, you have Cormier and Dom Cruz doing their one-minute hit in the first round, in the first minute of that round, where they're just talking, and it's super awkward because while they're giving their analysis, like, the fight is nearly finished, and John Anik's got to crack in for 10 seconds. This is super awkward. Let the guy that you have there do commentary. Anyways, that's my gripe. Your gripe is much more, like, makes sense. that bias kind of is obvious. And why do it if you have a large roster of people you can put on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of your criticism, I get what you're saying. I think that if you're going to do something like that, I think that's got to be where you're not going to commercial break and you're basically giving those guys 1 minute in between the round. And that the producer sits there and goes, look, guys, when they start the next round, you're done. We're going back to John and Brian. I understand your criticism, and I think it's valid criticism.
Yeah, we're fans of the sport, and this isn't like this is a sport where it's so unpredictable that you're essentially risking a minute every fight or whatever, a minute that you hope that the finish doesn't take place, and we know how ridiculous that is. They have the best color guys in the business. They have the top three guys in the business, top four guys that are on color in the business. I mean, Jimmy Smith, I guess, is a color guy too. For some reason, I think Jimmy's a play-by-play, even though he's not. So I guess top five. Those are the top five guys, I think. Mm-hmm. But use them wisely. Use them wisely is what I would say. And I say that because I was watching, you know, Shamrock and Mauro Ranallo do Ryzen. And it was great to listen to Mauro Ranallo. And I appreciate Shamrock just because he's a legend. But it's a stark contrast when you listen to Frank Shamrock do commentary. You think of the guys we listened to in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, and the guys you get now. The stark contrast is the color guys now, literally, they say things that matter, not just make noises. Like they have such good fight analysis, whereas a lot of the old color guys, you would have cliches. So I just wanted to make that point. You have five really great color guys, four in the UFC and one in Bellator.
Yeah, I mean, I've been listening to a lot of MMA broadcasts recently since I'm calling MMA card this weekend. And, you know, I think as play-by-play people, everyone has a different philosophy, you know. And, you know, when you have somebody sitting next to you that knows a lot about fighting as a play-by-play announcer, you try to lean on that person a lot because they, you know, at the end of the day, the viewer wants to hear more of that person. They want to hear the play-by-play guy who's just, you know, a communications major.
Yeah, totally, totally. But for like Mauro and Frank Shamrock last night or this morning, I mean, Mauro was the star of the show and he should have been. He should have been the guy shooting the ball because he was almost doing his own color for himself. Because for Frank, and again, I adore Frank. He's a legend. Like he totally is. And I got real nostalgic watching that card, but he just wasn't saying a whole lot of like analysis that made sense and was new and fresh. It was just a lot of, like I said, cliche and wasted space. But I mean, again, Brian Stann is great. And I really feel like the UFC is really hitting it on all cylinders with their production on that level.
And you sent me an interesting text that kind of relates to the UFC, to the Ryzen card, of course. Koji Horiguchi, first fight in Ryzen after his contract with the UFC expired. And you said, who would be the favorite, Horiguchi versus Wilson Heisen? And I don't think it's a question. I think I would immediately favor Koji Horiguchi without really even thinking very hard about it.
Yeah, I mean, and that speaks to the Ryzen card's quality, but not so much. Like, it does to an extent that you have a guy in Kyoji Horiguchi fighting on your card who is not in your main event, and he probably would have been favored against one of the main eventers on the UFC Fox card, but this was also a card that really had nothing too much else. I mean, the main event was two guys that I think probably could have still been in the UFC, and Anthony Berchek and Kyle Ujiri, and get into that later, but yeah, I mean, that's another storyline that we're going to just continue to beat into the ground, is that the UFC is letting these guys go who are really good at fighting. And it's becoming clear time and again. It didn't really rear its ugly head on this card, Jason. I didn't think about that too much during the UFC on Fox. It felt like every fight mattered and every fight had quality fighters. But and I tell you what, it was a blessing for them that I guess they got Jacare to re-sign right before this card. That was a nice one, because it did seem like every single card – the second storyline we would get to is, well, this fighter just won and he's a free agent.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about what's telling me about that, the situation with Jacare, of course, it was on Friday, Dana White announces that Jacare has signed a new 8-fight deal, which I never understand why guys do 8-fight deals. I reported this week that Curtis Blaydes, the young up-and-coming UFC heavyweight, had signed a new contract with the UFC. He had one fight left on his deal. He signed a 3-fight extension, so he has a new 4-fight deal for him, which I think 4 fights is probably the way you want to go if you're a fighter, because essentially, you know, that's a year and a half, 2-year deal. You know, a guy like Jacare, who's probably only going to fight 2, maybe if he's lucky, 3 times a year, 8-fight deal, we're talking like that's like a 3 to 4 year contract. Is that something you necessarily want, especially when you're Jacare, you're 37 years old, and not many, years left in your career. But to me, one of the things I thought of when I saw that is it's when the UFC truly wants you and they don't want to have a remote shot of losing you, they're going to sign you before you even hit that open market, which I think is somewhat telling about Gegard Mousasi, of maybe they're willing to let Gegard Mousasi walk away, that maybe they just don't feel that he's a part of, you know, that maybe the demands he want, they feel that he's just overshooting it, which, you know, I mean, this is the thing about free agency. And I know that, I mean, look, you can only, the only way you find out what you're worth is if you hit the open market and you have multiple people that are able to bid for your services. But this can also backfire on you. I mean, I think a perfect case of this, and this is a guy we're going to talk about later, but Aljamain Sterling. Free agency wasn't exactly what he thought it was going to be. There wasn't that big offer from Bellator, so, you know, and I was in a little, you know, tweet on Friday talking about this and said that, you know, if you're a soon-to-be free agent, you have to know Bellator's interested in you and that they're willing to throw big money at you, because if not, if all of a sudden the UFC makes you an offer and you decline it because you want to see what Bellator is going to offer, and then you go to Bellator and they don't offer you what the UFC is offering you, and you come back to the UFC, that initial offer may no longer be on the table.
Yeah, I tell you what, I think Bellator will probably regret not signing Aljo Sterling. I don't get that one. Look, man, the middleweight division of the UFC, look at the rankings. From 11 through 15, you got Talis Latis, Uriah Hall, Sam Alvey, Tim Bosch, Daniel Kelly. The UFC cannot afford not to re-sign Gegard Mousasi. If you don't re-sign top 10 fighters, your middleweight division, as great as it is today, will look like your 205-pound division. That's the issue. There are only so many top-quality fighters in each specific division, and if you lose just one, it's like a Jenga thing. You just keep on pulling out a block after block after block after block, and then, oh my God, Shogun, who is the fourth-ranked fighter in my division? Is Gegard Mousasi the most marketable thing? No, of course not, but he's damn good at fighting.
And but I think he's coming out of his shell, though.
He is, but... I tell you what, I feel like every fighter is. Didn't you get that feeling watching this card? Other than maybe Rose, like Rose didn't, but that's not really Rose Namajunas's, like, her personality. But I really feel like Whitaker who else? Zach Cummings was another one that just came across as a guy who understands how to market himself. Tim Elliott. It seems like everyone. The Conor McGregor effect is in full effect, I would say.
I mean, look, at the end of the day, this is the entertainment business, and you got to get people interested in you. And that's, I think, a lot of these fighters do know. Before we get into the whole Whitaker-Jacare situation, let's talk a little bit about the co-main event, Rose Namajunas versus Michelle Waters. And we talked about it on the preview show. Look, I think everyone knew, in an ideal situation, the UFC would have loved if Michelle Waters got the win. However, Rose Namajunas, first off, how did the head kick land by Rose not put Michelle Waterson to sleep? I think that says a lot about Michelle Waterson in terms of it. But, you know, the way this fight went down, not exactly. Not, you know, in the words of Nate Diaz, not surprised. You know what he says.
Yeah, dude. Somebody needs to get in the UFC headquarters. I tell you what the UFC needs to do. They just need to read all the prediction articles we MMA journalists do. So they have a general idea what the hell is going to take place, because Jesus, the marketing was all the eggs were in Michelle Waterson's basket, which is just a very, very bad idea, because Rose Namajunas was the favorite, and for good reason. Waterson is skilled. She had some nice moments. Well, she had a couple. For a few seconds, she looked good in this fight, for sure. But for the most part, this was pure, utter violence and domination by Rose Namajunas. Michelle Waterson is marketable. They got her over. I think she's going to have a lot of interesting fights moving forward, but it's kind of clear, Jason, that Rose Namajunas, she has immense upside in terms of her skill level as a fighter, man. I think the three things that I would touch on was the composure she showcased. In some issues on the ground where you have a real respected grappler, she kept her calm. It was all like, I'm going to escape and then get in a better position. Her athleticism was evident. She is just so damn athletic, and probably number one would be her movement. It felt like everything made sense. She was so smooth, and it almost at times felt like she was kind of competing in a different sport than Michelle Waterson. I got that sense with Rose, and I got that sense with Whitaker, man. With just the way they fought, it felt like they they were in control from the beginning to the end. And for Rose, you talk about someone who has been around for a decent amount of time, but still has less than 10 fights and is 24 years old. If you're the UFC, how do you not watch that fight and then begin marketing around her? I understand that she hasn't embraced the marketing side of the sport, but you got to embrace your good fighters regardless of what they think.
I think this is where if you're, whether it's Dana White or anyone inside the UFC, WME, IMG, this is where you have to sit down with Rose and her management, and I think you have to put together a plan of how do you make her a star? How do you get people interested in watching her fight, interested if she's in a co-main event of a pay-per-view or even a main event of the pay-per-view fighting for a title? How do you get people interested in this? Obviously, she has to be, at this point, the leading candidate for the next title challenge. Now, everyone knows that Ioana is going to defend the title next month against Jessica Andrade. Now, if Jessica Andrade defeats, upsets Ioana and Jędrzejczyk, you probably would imagine the UFC would probably go right back to an immediate rematch if that were to happen. And I'm really interested in Ioana and Jessica because I think that's going to be a very interesting fight on the feed, of course, at UFC 212. You've got Gedalia and Carolina. And so a lot of this is timing in terms of if she is going to be next. I mean, yes, she was coming off that loss to Carolina, but if Joanna wins at UFC 211, which I think most people are expecting her to retain the title, I have no problems if you're going to go Joanna against Rose, and I would not pick Rose against over Joanna.
Yeah, Joanna's in a special category with DJ where none of her challenges make sense. I think if you look at all the top 15 women strawweight, Rose probably represents the biggest chance to beat Joanna. But again, when I say that, and I see what Jessica Andrade may be right there with her, and Claudia Gadelha probably rounds out the top three. I don't know what the order is, but again, Joanna has established herself as just you don't pick against her until she loses, and that may never happen in the history of the world. So, Rose probably is next just because when you look at the fighters above her, they're either going to be the next challenger or have losses. I love the Gadelha-Kovacevic matchup. So Rose is probably next. It's kind of weird having a fighter with only one win get a title shot, but it makes sense, especially if you watch that fight. And in terms of marketing her, I think you gotta go with the tide if you're the UFC. Maybe, it would be really weird if you see Rose Namajunas like in a dress and high heels and extensions next time. It would be awful and no one would buy it. Rose is Rose and she's a badass because of it. So market her for being her and unique and stuff like that. I think if you market her as being hyper focused or just like a badass killer or something like that or whatever, find what's interesting about her and market that. Go with the flow. Don't necessarily mold her. With that being said, you do have to have a discussion in terms of, hey, maybe do a few more interviews, but that's probably it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where you just, as I said, I think if you're the UFC and you got to sit down with Rose and her management and you got to put together a plan of how do we make you into a star, because at the end of the day, it's the entertainment business. You got to get people interested to want to watch you fight, to me. And the UFC is going to put fires at fans, people and casual sports fans that they want to sit in front of their television and watch these fights. Now, of course, we mentioned a little bit about Jacare in terms of his new contract, but man, what a performance by Robert Whittaker. And I think the thing that you can talk about the ending sequence, which obviously we'll talk about here momentarily. But to me, the thing that I am so impressed with Robert Whittaker is the fact of when that fight went to the ground, he remained calm. He stuck to his fundamentals. I mean, there's a lot of guys, and we have seen this. They get in that situation against Jacare, and they absolutely fold. They forget about their fundamentals. But to me, that is what I am most impressed about Robert Whittaker is he got in some adversity, didn't break down, sticks to his fundamentals, gets out of it. To me, that's the thing that I walk away with, blown away with what he was able to do in that first round.
Yeah, that was – for every fighter, you highlight their strengths, and we know the strengths of Robert Whittaker. And the answer for whether or not they're able to become a great fighter or champion is how do they answer when their weaknesses are put on display? And he answered with a flying – he passed, right? He came in this fight with 94% takedown defense, and he got taken down. He got right up immediately. And you had Jacare Souza on your back, and he shucked him off. And from that point forward, it was the Robert Whittaker show, man. It was not close at all. I went and rewatched that fight this morning because one of the questions we got, and I was just, and I knew it was a beatdown, but there was not like a single strike that Jacare threw from like the midway point of the first round to the end of the fight where I was like, oh, that's a good strike. Yeah. Like, this was just, it was crazy that Jacare, who, I mean, this, I don't know what was more impressive. This victory for Whitaker or the Weidman win for Romero, but that's the fight I want to see next, Jason. I want to see them. I want to see Whitaker take on the middleweight champion, Yoel Romero.
I threw out Luke Rockhold. And that's, I mean, a fight Rockhold wants. I think Edgar Musasi, if he were to sign with the UFC, there's several interesting matchups for Robert Whitaker, and this is a guy that the UFC has felt was going to be a star for them for a long time. Of course, remember back in 2012, he won the Ultimate Fire, the Smashes, and a guy that primarily they have used in Australia and New Zealand, which that's what they should do, but they have brought him over here to the United States. But let's talk about the finishing sequence. First off, I have no issues with the stoppage. It's a weird stoppage just because of the placement of Mario Yamasaki. And we got this question from Quiggins MMA saying, I'm sure I won't be the only one to ask, but do you think Mario Yamasaki was a little too close and prevented Jacare from moving? Was he a little too close? I think you could say that, but to me, and you see it, once Jacare got up, he was knocked out. I mean, it was a good stoppage, but it's just the way Mario was positioned made it weird.
Yeah, I think Mario was too close, but that did not prevent Jacare from moving, if that makes any sense. First and foremost, if Jacare wanted to move, he would run his ass right through Mario Yamasaki. I mean, poor Mario would look like a Super Smash Brother character after it, because you are not going to get in the way of a guy who's a fighter who's getting the crap beat out of him and wants to escape. All right. He's like a dog kind of just escaping. So he wouldn't have prevented anything. It was very awkward. That's how I would describe it. The whole finishing sequence was awkward. There's no part of me that says that was a bad stoppage. I'm finding it hard, Jason, to really come out here on these post-fight shows and never call a stoppage early when you know, I mean, when you know kind of the toll this sport takes on the brain and stuff like that, you can always run back a rematch, but you can't run back a fight that gets stopped too late. You know, that could – who knows what kind of role that took place with Weidman. Obviously, JDS rebounded well after the beatdown there. He's, you know, contending for a title. I mean, he's put himself in a nice position, but I would say, Jason, that the stoppage wasn't bad, but I would also say that it wasn't definitive. Jacare wasn't completely out, but he was clearly groggy and out of it, not knocked out cold.
Well, if you remember the first time that Whitaker dropped him, Mario, it seemed like, was about a second away from stopping the fight, and Jacare kind of rebounded a little bit. And I love the fact of Whitaker's like, we ain't playing that ground game. Stand up. By the way, kudos to John Anik for calling him Bobby Knuckles. Anyone who listens to the Co-Main Event podcast with Ben Folks and Chad Dundas knows that is their nickname for Robert Whitaker. So, maybe Reebok will say, hey, maybe we need to do a Bobby Knuckles shirt and get a little royalty to those guys. But kudos for John Anik for doing that. But to me, no issue with stoppage. I think the word you use, awkward, I think that's a great way to describe that stoppage. And, you know, you look at Robert Whitaker, and we've talked about this multiple times. You think about things that have happened over the past 2 years at middleweight. What would have happened if Whitaker actually fought Michael Bisping at UFC 193? I would have picked Robert Whitaker. And then, of course, what if Michael Bisping doesn't become the UFC middleweight champion last year? I mean, how different this division is if Luke Rockhold beats Michael Bisping, you know, nearly 1 year ago?
Yeah, we would have compelling championship fights. Look, let's stay woke here, Jason. Let's stay woke. If I told you today championships didn't matter, I want you to book the most intriguing fight at 185 pounds. Is that fight not Yoel Romero versus Robert Whitaker? I feel like that's the fight. That's the fight that pits the two best guys at 185 pounds against each other. Maybe I'm wrong here, but I just think that's the fight that you would make if you pick one versus two.
No, Musasi, I would put ahead of Whitaker.
You would put Musasi over Whitaker?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just because of what Musasi's done throughout his career. The fact that he just beat the former UFC middleweight champion, I would put him. I mean, if you're telling me how I'm ranking them right now, number one would be Yoel Romero. I would still put, you know, Luke Rockhold number two in the world. Number three would be Gegard. Number four would be Whitaker. And number five would be Jacare. And then six would be Weidman.
Yeah, I guess the one thing holding Whitaker back would be the quality opponent quotient. You obviously have a quality opponent in Jacare. And I would raise you that what he just did to Jacare is probably more impressive than anything Musasi has done. Save for, I don't know, maybe the Dan Henderson win back in the day. So, but after that, then you're talking about wins over Brunson, Natal, Hall. That's when you can talk me out of a Whitaker there. I think the reason with Whitaker where I'm so enthusiastic about him is I feel like with him, he's on the trajectory to be that guy. And he may already be that guy. He just hasn't had the opportunity to contend against these other guys. I would feel confident picking him against these guys because, I mean, we went to this pre-fight show, and just time and again, man, Robert Whitaker changes my narrative on how good he think he is. I think we both picked Jacare in this fight. And, I mean, this one, it was straight up beat down. It wasn't close at all. But, I mean, the middleweight division isn't a nice place for sure. You can't really go wrong with it. Even though the UFC kind of has, it's kind of crazy again so at the end of the day, what you're saying is what's next? What do you think is next for 185 with Musasi, Rockhold, Whitaker, Romero? What would you ideally want there?
Ideally, I would want for us not to have Michael Bisping, GSP. I mean, I think at this point with where this division is right now, you could realistically do a pay-per-view that has five 185-pound fights to where, you know, it could really get you interested in that division. I mean, if you took GSP out of this scenario, you know, if you had your main event, Michael Bisping versus Yoel Romero, and I think we both agree Yoel Romero would be the next UFC middleweight champion. And then in terms of, you know, what else you would do, I would do Luke Rockhold against Gegard Mousasi. Just, you know, rankings aspect, you could put Whitaker in that situation. You know, then you start to kind of get in this very weird situation of, okay, maybe you do Jacare Weidman, but then what's that leave Robert Whitaker? You know, it's all time is going to match up, but look, we're going to see Bisping GSP, whether it happens July or later on. I like, you know, Rockhold versus Whitaker. I think you can make that matchup now because, hey, we don't know what's going to happen with Gegard Mousasi. I'm 50-50 in whether Gegard returns to the UFC or not, and I think that's kind of plays into it. But, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that people weren't exactly interested in 185 pounds, and look at this division now to where the UFC has multiple fights that have you interested.
Yeah, it's the strongest division when you look at the top five fighters for sure. I mean, I would probably put that division right up there with maybe, I guess lightweight too, but maybe not. Maybe it is middleweight.
How about 135?
135, you got, who you got there? You got Dillashaw, Cruz.
Sunsau, Lineker, Rivera, Carroll, yeah. Dotson, Sterling, Almeida, you gotta throw Dukuwa in there. I mean,
that's a good 6-10. That 6-10 makes it for sure pop out. I mean, that's a hell of a division too. You're right, Dukuwa too. I don't know what to think about him quite yet, Jason. I was probably higher on him headed into this card than I am out of it, but I'm still high on him. If that makes any sense.
You don't, you know. And I pose this question on my social media: is who do you put for him next? Someone had mentioned Yuri Alcantara. I saw someone else mention Albert Morales. I like that Morales matchup. I mean, I think the key thing if you're the UFC in terms of building up Tom Dukuwa is don't put him in there against wrestlers.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it eventually, but probably if you're saying we want to build a guy at 135, Tom Dukuwa is that guy, especially to run it back right after this Patrick Williams fight. It is definitely a no-go. Maybe down the line, two or three fights from now. I mean, at some point, you just have to match up against the best fighters. But look, man, he looked very, very bad in that first round. Obviously, he ended it in great fashion. Patrick Williams was just about to pull off one of the biggest upsets of the year for the first 3 minutes of this round. I mean, he put Dukuwa in a real bad way. Dukuwa rebounded, and he got the finish. It felt like the fight was over as the first round ended.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, A lot of people, when they're talking about that fight, even Brian Sand, maybe I'm the only one that thought this, but they were just saying about how Williams was absolutely gassed. I thought that Williams was gassed because he got rocked in the end of that first round. Maybe I missaw that and he just slipped. But I felt like Duquesnoy like rocked him badly, and then Williams, I mean, that probably takes a toll on your cardio, and he was just out of it from that point forward. Maybe he was just so tired, but yeah, Duquesnoy looked great, but you got to slow your roll with him. This wasn't an A+. This was like a B-.
It's still an impressive victory by him. I mean, I think there's a case you could say that maybe that fight should have been stopped at the end of the first round. I mean, Patrick Williams was saved by the bell. I did think he was slowing down, and after the fact, Patrick Williams did post on social media that his days at 135 are done. He's going to move up to 145 pounds. But, I mean, just brutal elbows landed. And you just hope that this is not a guy that gets rushed into, you know, a top 15 type fight. I think you just hope that there's a little bit of a natural progression here. I think he's a guy that you can definitely use overseas. And look, he's only 24 years old. So, I mean, you know, but 135, I mean, it's amazing what has happened to that division. Of course, Aljamain Sterling earlier on this fight card, he got a win against Augusto Mendez. One of the things that impressed me about Aljo in that fight is surviving the submission attempts of Augusto Mendez there in the opening round. I thought it was a great performance by Aljo. He mentioned after the fact if he had to change up his fighting style a little bit to appease the judges. But, of course, you know, the judges are only a factor if you let the judges be a factor.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the problem. That's like the never-ending paradox of the sport where – you know, you don't leave it in the hands of the judges, but how messed up at this sport that you can't leave it in the hands of the judges? That's the never-ending solution. Never-ending existential question that we will continue to ask ourselves until we are nothing but dust when it comes to being a mixed martial arts fan. But, you know, Aljo looked good. Augusto Mendez, very, very skilled. That speaks to the depth at 135, that you have a guy like that at 1-2, and I'm so excited. But granted, those two losses are to fairly talented fighters in Cody Garbrandt and Sterling. I love watching Aljamain Sterling fight because he's so good. Immense upside. Continues to look solid, solid, solid. I think his next fight is going to be really, really good. But I also love watching Aljo Sterling fight because I love his corner. One of the best corners in the game.
Yeah, I mean, it's can we just get Longo and Sarah reality show?
Because we already promoted the damn Dana White looking for a fight show with him freaking every fight. So let's give them a show, too, and split half the promo time. I mean, Jesus, is that YouTube video of Dana White have 500 million views at this point in time? How many times do you have to mention that on national TV?
I mean, I know the word is they're going on that show is going on Netflix, but I think that's not till maybe middle of 2017 or whatnot. But
I swear to God, get another ad read. All right, they did the damn thing 500 times. I don't care that they went to South Dakota. Tell me about it a few times and then stop it. I don't even hear it every time.
The thing about that show, really, ultimately, is you just really fast forward to the end to see kind of who they sign. And, but for the most part, you already know before it airs of who they signed.
I want to see a show called Scott Coker Looking for a Fighter. And it's just Scott Coker wearing a mask in the backstage area of a UFC show, signing whoever is the latest free agent.
Yeah, it definitely is a storyline there. By the way, speaking of who maybe we could see in Bellator in the not too near future, who knows what's going to happen. Roy Nelson loses to Alexander Volkov. First off, big assist there at the last minute of the first round from, I believe it was Dan Bergliotta, who, Roy was, he had a dominant position for the most part. I mean, maybe you hope that he should have been a little more active, but then a little bit of a brawl there at the end of the first round. But a clear win for Alexander Volkov. And at 40 years old and seeing what we've seen out of Roy Nelson, even though, you know, to me it's weird that he wasn't a top 15 guy, but this was his first fight following that suspension, what happened in Brazil. And I saw, once this fight was ending, I even saw Brett Okamoto with a tweet of basically, saying, hey, taking away the fighting aspect, Roy Nelson probably needs to lose some weight just for his health, being, where he's at in his career. You know, we got this question asking if we got this question actually before during the pre-fight show, which I don't think we got to this. So I wanted to get to us here. And this is from @Justin8S says, you guys think the UFC parts ways with Roy Nelson? given the McCarthy incident, no promotion, and has not been on this low on the card in years. And yes, I mean, I think this was, I mean, typically Roy is either a main event or a co-main event fighter for the most part for the UFC. You know, but you still see, I mean, fans love him. You know, it's because of his fighting style, but at where he's at now, is he a top 15 guy?
Let's see, top 15. You got Tim Johnson, Marcin Tybura, Alexei Oleinik, Daniel Olmanchuk. Maybe he's 15th. Yeah, I would probably say 15th, but wouldn't be surprised if he loses the next fight and then the fight after, because it felt like he was pretty listless in this one. He just didn't have a lot from the offensive standpoint, specifically power. He was able to land at times against Volkov, but it didn't feel like the Roy Nelson of old. Again, Roy didn't look super bad. He just looked kind of bad. And you know, he ain't going to lose weight, probably, but that's okay. Like, he's still a good athlete. I mean, he's kind of like Dusty Rhodes, right? The American dream where, yeah, this guy's got a pot belly, but he's pretty athletic and he's content with it. So, I don't know. I don't know what the contract situation is like. This is actually one of the, if you're looking at it from a cold-blooded UFC standpoint, you probably do think he's probably not worth the contract at this point in time. And he's 40 years old. He ain't going to grab that brass ring. So maybe you do say goodbye. With that being said, this is somebody Bellator could sign, put on TV, and people would care about. So I would say he's still valuable. I would say we're probably going to see him fight five more times in his career at the very least, because that's just the way I feel like his brain is wired. He took a lot of hard shots from Alexander Volkov. Volkov looked solid here, 2-0 in the UFC, right? I actually wouldn't have anticipated that. But this is a guy who is really using his frame in a smart way, and I would love to see Volkov fight Stefan Struve.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a matchup that a lot of people mention. I mean, I don't think that Roy's days in the UFC are over, but, you know, if I think they give him at least one more fight. If he loses that, I don't think you would see him in the UFC much longer. With his relationship with Mike Kogan, who's one of the executives over there at Bellator, I would imagine that if Roy did want to fight Bellator, would definitely bring him in. But, you know, it's, you know, everyone's known for years it's about that overhand right with Roy. And it's just, you know, we haven't seen that overhand right. And you just wonder, has Father Time caught up there with Roy Nelson? The opening matchup of the main card, Jeremy Stephens and Hinato Makano. Hinato's not going to win fans with that performance, but at the end of the day, he fought a smart fight.
It's a fight that ages well. When you're watching it live, you get a bit frustrated with the way he moves away, but you go and you watch this one on Fight Pass 2 years from now, and I think you got to come away real impressed with Hinato Makano. He went up against a top five featherweight, right, and Jeremy Stephens, and completely outstruck him. Stevens clearly had nice moments, but he looked frustrated time and again. Hinato Makano came in with a great game plan. No one's going to look forward to his next fight, but he's a highly skilled fighter. He displayed that. Probably not someone you put on your main card on Fox next time out, but at the end of the day, he's going to be a factor at 145.
Yeah, it was, he fought a smart fight, and you got to give him kudos for that. In terms of preliminary card, Lewis Smolka, Tim Elliott, what a fight. I mean, that was just an awesome fight.
That was just, you know, something that wakes you up, because sometimes you get in the malaise of watching fights, and it just follows the same rhythm. 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, another decision. Was that controversial? Well, I'm so tired, I don't really care. That one woke you up, man. You know, it was followed by kind of a lackluster fight in Green and Magomedov, but how could Magomedov and Green follow up that? Tim Elliott, I love watching this dude fight. I love watching this dude talk, and Luis Smolka was a great tango partner. Despite the fact that Elliott clearly won every single round, a lot of the grappling counters by Smolka were exciting. This fight was just nonstop things happening, and I loved it. I'm sure you did too, right? It was just a no-brainer for Fight of the Night, and a fight that didn't have a whole lot of dramatic striking exchanges, but it didn't need it to be considered one of the better fights we've seen so far in 2017.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows that you can have a fight that's just grappling scrambles on the ground that can be exciting, just a fun fight. Smolka has now dropped 3 in a row, but no way should the UFC part ways with him. He should get another fight in the UFC. And, you know, Tim Elliott, I mean, when you talk about guys who you would be interested in watching a rematch against DJ, Tim Elliott is one of those guys.
Yeah, it's going to take a while. Give him a couple more fights. But yeah, down the line, that's one you could market. That's a guy who is unique, who can talk well, and who you want to watch fight. That's a guy you can put on main card TV. And I mean, for all intents and purposes, he was on main card TV when you run back to back Fox cards. I hate that so much, just because it may dilute your product, and potentially you have someone tune in. They watch Rashid Magomedov, Bobby Green, and think that's what your product is, and then tune out. That's why I don't like it too much. And I'm really crapping on that Bobby Green Rashid fight. It wasn't that bad. It was fine. It was totally fine. It was a good fight. Just not as good as Elliott and Smolka. But I mean, Tim Elliott, a shining star. I think when you're kind of crowning the guys that are the men and women that define this event, you got to go with Rose and Whitaker and DJ, top three. But right under that, I would put Tim Elliott in that group.
Also on this card, you had Devin Clark get a decision win over Jay Collier, a clear decision win for him. Anthony Smith, a come-from-behind victory against Andrew Sanchez, a brutal knockout there in the third round. Zach Cummings, submission win against Nathan Coy, and also Caitlin Vieira gets a win over Ashley Evans-Smith. And you got to mention about Zach Cummings and Nathan Coy. Apparently, Mike Englund, first off, he shouldn't be refereeing a UFC fight, flat out. And I don't know how after, I mean, it's not good when your announcers are saying stop the fight. That's never a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right, Jason. They didn't just say stop the fight. They repeated it twice. I thought this was a bad one. And I know this is more your corner than mine. I'm such a lackadaisical person, laissez-faire. But at the end of the day, when you have a mistake this dramatic, and it's not like he was in a bad position, right? There has to be some type of action taken. And Mike Englund, I think, is a guy who has a history of kind of bad stoppages, right?
He does. I mean, everyone will remember what happened in Invicta with Tommy Evinger at a recent Invicta event. But, you know, it's one of those things of, A, first off, how does in the lead up to this fight card when the commission gives all of what they want to assign to the UFC and Mark Ratner, how does Mark Ratner not kind of say, I don't want Mike Englund on this card? You know, we have seen what he has done in the past. We just feel that he shouldn't be working our event. And then after this happens where, I mean, it's a good 5 seconds that Nate Coy is asleep before he finally stops the fight. And you do, if you go back and you watch the replay, you can see where Nate Coy kind of taps. And then, you know, it's just awful. It's just awful to see. And these are the type of things where the referee is supposed to be in there to protect the fighters. Mike Englund did not protect Nathan Coy. And I don't even know how the Missouri Athletic Commission allowed Mike Englund to work fights the rest of the night, which they did. To me, that is unbelievable. If I was a manager of a fighter on this card later on the event and I knew Mike Englund was a referee, I'm immediately going finding Mark Ratner, and then I'm immediately going finding Tim Lukenhoff and going, please explain to me why you think Mike Englund should be reffing a fight tonight.
Yeah.
It's awful. I can tell you, I talked to somebody on the regulatory side about this after the fact. These are the type of things that have to get addressed. And this is where, you know, in the NFL, there is a pool reporter for every city that has the ability to go talk to the officials after the game. Here in Tampa, it's Greg Allman of the Tampa Bay Times. He has that ability after the game to go down to the officials' locker room, and basically he can ask questions, get quotes, and then he supplies it to the rest of the media. To me, we need that in MMA to where designate somebody or an outlet that you know is going to be there every time. So pretty much, you know, MMA Junkie is at every event. So whether it's John Morgan, it's Matt Erickson, or whoever else is going to be there, who's constantly there. I mean, John Morgan is probably the best guy to go with. Is sit there and say, John, you know, you and your outlet, whether you're here or someone else is here, is going to have the ability to sit there and have a conversation with the commission, the referees, and or the judges, you know, to basically offer decision. I mean, I would love to sit there and look at Mike Englund and go, okay, please explain to me why you saw the things the way you saw it. I mean, we need that clarity because, and unfortunately, for the most part, referees won't talk to the media. And I think part of that is the fact of I think they maybe don't want to answer the questions, which I will tell you, I actually am working on getting a referee on the MMA Insiders podcast. It's probably not going to be till probably July when I go to the ABC meeting. But I am interested to talk to a referee and talk to him about these situations. And how you become a better referee. Because I think right now, how if you're the Missouri Athletic Commission or any athletic commission that assigns Mike England to work a fight, how can you sit there and say he is truly making sure both fighters are safe, you know, no matter what happens? I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, this is a fight, but how do you make sure that, you know, you don't have a guy unconscious in a chokehold for 5 seconds?
Yeah, this is a sport that is balancing. It's balancing something tough. It's balancing, like, tragic injury, right? And the people in charge of making sure tragic injury does not take place, the referees, the doctors, they should be held accountable, and the process should be 100% transparent. If there is any process in this sport that requires full transparency, clear transparency, it's the officiating. This isn't the NBA or the NFL where a missed call means, you know, 15 yards weren't taken. A missed call is potentially, you know, career threatening. Mm-hmm. And when you have a guy unconscious for several seconds and the fight hasn't stopped, it's a rough bit of business there. And transparency is the answer, and accountability is the answer. And because of that lack of transparency, Jason, we aren't aware of whatever accountability takes place. You know, I haven't really seen too many cards lately of Kim Winslow and Steve Mazzagatti being referees.
They're working. I mean, there's not a lot of regional shows in Las Vegas. It's just, it's, I guess the best way to put it is it's not very financially smart for people to run regional shows in Las Vegas, just unless you have a lot of money behind them. But they do work those smaller shows. But guys like Mike England, Steve Mazzagatti, Kim Winslow, they shouldn't be working UFC events, plain and simple.
Yeah, and to your point about pull them from the card, you could have done that. Mergliotta, Yamasaki, and Keith Peterson were on the scene. You know, some of the best referees in the sport weren't in the building there. Jason Herzog was at Ryzen. Big John was in Europe with Bellator and ACB, and Herb Dean was at Road FC. So the best guys weren't there. But Jason, does there not have to be some better level of accountability where if you continue to screw up or you make obvious mistakes that aren't just this wasn't really like a reaction. This was a reaction and processing error, and it took too long.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be, you know, and I know there's a lot of training that goes on, but yeah, I mean, something has to be done about that. And you know, and I'm sure the Missouri Athletic Commission won't comment to anyone about Mike England. That's just they tend not to like to talk. That's just, yeah. That's been my that's been in my experience with them. They tend not to talk, especially when you start questioning about drug testing. They get real quiet, quiet. But of course, that is UFC on Fox 24.
I just wanted to say real quick, yeah. Great crowd in Missouri. That was a lively ass crowd.
Oh, and by the way, you know, of course, this was the first time the UFC's gone there. My understanding is the reason the UFC hasn't gone to the state of Missouri is actually has to do with the Fertittas and their casinos and issues with the state of Missouri in terms of the casino business. So obviously, you know, Dana mentioned about potentially going to St. Louis, which I think would make all the sense in the world to have Tyron Woodley headline the St. Louis card. So we'll see what happens there. But of course, coming up on Saturday, you've got UFC Fight Night in Nashville. Cub Swanson versus Artem Lobov is the main event of that fight card. Also, you have the return of Ally Quinta as he's going to be taking on Diego Sanchez. Of course, we're going to have a preview show later on this week. Of course, we'll preview that card. Also, we'll talk about Bellator 178, but of course, Bellator 177 took place on Friday in Budapest and was, not the greatest of cards. You had two split decisions in the main event and co-main event. You had, two catchweight matchups on this fight card. Leandro Higo misses weight by 4 pounds. He was fined 20% of his purse. Eduardo Dantas does get the split decision win. I thought this was 29-28. I favored Eduardo Dantas. I have no problems if you had it for Higo based on that last minute of the second round. But, you know, Eduardo Dantas, I just feel like the past couple of fights, I think that optimism you had for Eduardo Dantas at one time is totally gone.
I mean, no one watches those recent fights and comes away looking forward to the next Eduardo Dantas fight. This one was boring, and it was just like maybe it's because he was prepared for a five-round fight, But the pacing of this one was so slow for guys that are supposed to weigh 135 pounds. And he didn't come away this one enthused about Eduardo Dantas. I think he's good, obviously. His stand-up looked solid, and the jab was great. The kicks were great. It just was he wasn't able to really do much more than that. And his movement was so well that his opponent wasn't able to do too much either. So I felt like the hype on Dantas is probably much higher, like in 2011, than it is in 2017 or whatever. So yeah. This was a rough one. I don't know. I thought this fight sucked. How about you?
Yeah, no, it was not a thrilling fight to watch there. I think the Darren Caldwell fight, it is a fight to make there, so we'll see if they go there. Daniel Vichel, a win over John Scherer, split decision. I did not have this for Daniel Vichel. I thought he lost. I thought he lost 29-28.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess now it's John Makapa, Jason.
Yeah. I still
But it doesn't matter, right? Either way, Teixeira's his name, and Makapa is a new rename, homage to his city, right, in Brazil. But, I agree with you. I think most people did have it 29-28 for Teixeira. I think if you're going by pride rules, you could talk yourself into Weichel winning this one because he was beginning to land more significant strikes at maybe a slower pace, especially in round two. He clearly won rounds three, but the story of this one was John Makapa won rounds one and two fairly clearly. It was all about volume, all about pace and being comfortable. And I think if you show this fight to 10 people, 9 of them would tell you Teixeira won 29-28.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know what's odd to me in relation to this fight card is the way Bellator has match made Anthony Taylor. When you listen to Anthony Taylor do interviews, this guy is tremendous. The guy knows how to promote a fight, but they have just put him in, you know, back-to-back tough fights, both losses. He's now lost, three of his four pro fights. All the losses come by rear naked choke, and he gets a groin shot where probably should have taken a little more time than he did. But maybe Bellator found a prospect there in Hungary of Adam Borax. Also, Lena, she gets a TKO win there at the end of the second round. But I think for the most part, this is a Bellator event that people will not remember probably, I don't know, in 2 weeks.
Yeah, we'll only talk about this for like a short period, but just to beat him to the ground. This should have been live on Spike. That card last week.
But they're never going to put a card on a Friday afternoon. That's
okay,
just,
no. But that should have been Saturday afternoon. I'm sorry. That should have been Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, no.
Obviously not.
If you're going to do these international events, do them on Saturday. Do them in the afternoon. I mentioned on the preview podcast that I think that they should sell these digital rights to somebody like a Flow Combat, which I will tell you, people privately reached out to me about that. It doesn't seem that, that's probably a route they're going to go, but it's unfortunate because Spike and Viacom do not treat Bellator like a sports property, which what it is. They treat it like a quote unquote non-scripted program, which is a wording they have used in a press release in talk about the Paramount Networks coming up. It's unfortunate for fans. And the fact of we are talking about Paul Daly versus Rory McDonald is a tape delayed fight. Think about that one. One of the best welterweight fights that can be made in all of MMA is going to be on a 6-hour tape delay.
If you aren't valuing live sports as live sports in 2017, you're not playing the game right. I mean, the game is live sports is where it's at. Bellator 176 did what, 438,000 viewers and peaked at 688,000. That is great for that time slot. For that time slot in the middle of the day, that's pretty damn good. And if you begin to build some level of familiarity of your international cards being live at that time slot, that's a win, man. It maybe do a rerun the same night. You may get decent viewership there. Sell those ads. But it makes sense to do it live. And if there's any fight to do it, Jason, Daly McDonald is the damn fight to do it. That's a fight you could have put on your pay-per-view and it would have made it look great.
You tell me, you think you couldn't do an internet pay-per-view for Paul Daly, Rory McDonald, and Michael Page, and that people wouldn't pay $10?
Yeah, I just wouldn't spend $15 for that Ryzen car that certainly isn't as Horiguchi's probably means more to flyweight division than Daly does to welterweight, but that card has just as many strong fights as that Ryzen card, and I went and watched that one in the middle of the night. So, yeah, there's an audience for that. And missed opportunity. Missed opportunity. Granted, I'm speaking more from like the perspective of business, because like I usually watch these cards tape delay anyway. Even if they're in America, I tend to watch it the day after. But it just makes no sense to me.
But Bellator will return on Friday night for Bellator 178, headlined by the fourth fight between Daniel Strauss and Patricio Pitbull. Also, the co-main event is a flyweight matchup, Alimaleh McFarlane against Jessica Middleton. A great featherweight matchup, Dominic Mazzotta versus AJ McKee. Also, you have Syed Awad against Ryan Quinn. And if you head over to themareport.com, you can watch an interview that I did with Tim Caron, who's going to be a part of the preliminary card. He'll be taking on fellow undefeated middleweight Jordan Young. Also, you have Tyrell Fortune and Ed Ruth on this fight card. Ed Ruth is actually taking on Aaron Goodwin, who was Goodwine, who was actually supposed to be on the card that I was going to be calling on Friday, but he is now in this opportunity. And Tyrell Fortune taking on a fighter making his pro debut, which if anyone decides to Google his name, they'll see he's had some past issues. He's getting a second chance here, it's a showcase fight for Tyrell Fortune. We all know that's what it is, but we'll have a preview podcast for that coming up on Friday. Coming up on Friday, I will be calling the Battleground Show here in Tampa. We'll be on Fight TV. If you are within a 72-mile radius of Tampa, that fight card is blacked out. So if you want to go to, if you want to watch those fights on Friday, you actually have to be at the Tampa Convention Center. But there was a ton of other MMA that went on this weekend. You mentioned about the Ryzen card. I have seen the GIF of the Tyrion Cruikshank knockout where he got knocked out. Oh my God.
Yeah, that was probably the big storyline if you're a fan in the States. Out of anything, was the upset loss to Yusuke Yachi. I think for Tyrion Cruikshank, he was the lone favorite to lose, and it was brutal. He was winning that fight the first few minutes. It was him, pressure, success on the feet, time and again. He got overconfident, and probably it's what's going to happen if you come out to Real American, the Hulk Hogan theme song, and he got caught. And it was a brutal knockout, wasn't it? That makes sense to me that was the thing coming out of this car, because, first and foremost, tough loss for Cruikshank in the middle of Japan. One day you're in the UFC, and the next day you're knocked out cold in the Yokohama Arena, and you're not even the main event. I mean, that was early on in the card with that loss.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the rest of that Ryzen card, Kawajiri gets a decision win over Burchak. If you check in, I think Burchak's Twitter, not necessarily exactly happy with how that fight did play out there. Horiguchi also getting a win. Satoshi Ishii with the win over Heath Herring. Overall, I mean, did you enjoy the morning of Ryzen fights? I guess the best way to describe it.
Did I enjoy it? You know what? I'm really excited about the potential of Ryzen. I think this sets up to be a really interesting promotion. There's a nostalgic aspect of watching this card in the middle of the night, watching it in Yokohama Arena next time, Saitama Super Arena. Mauro Ranallo, great to have him back and listening to him do commentary. This card in of itself left more to be desired. The Heath Herring Satoshi Ishii fight, Ishii won it. That fight was awful. It was Ishii holding on to Heath Herring the whole time. Alpha Female left more to be desired, I must say. She came out and tried to strike with this girl named Reyna. It was like Don Fry Takayama for 30 seconds, and then she just got taken down and eventually got tapped out. Burchak Kawajiri was also boring. I don't really care that Burchak is on Twitter saying he was trying to hold me. Bro, you're a top-level featherweight. It's your responsibility not to get held. Okay, you didn't do much to not get held. You're supposed to be a great fighter. Show some good wrestling defense or ability to get back up on your feet. That fight was pretty boring. Horiguchi looked great, Jason. Obviously, he wasn't able to finish his opponent, but that speaks more to Yuki Motoya's ability to survive. You had a fighter, Amir Ali Bari, in the co-main event, a heavyweight fighter. It was an open weight bout. Geronimo dos Santos was his opponent. He weighed like 280 some pounds. Ali Bari won the fight pretty convincingly. And then the only other thing I would mention would probably be this kid named Tenshin Nasukawa. He's 3-0. He's 18 years old. Colored hair. He is very charismatic, undefeated, came out, finished his opponent with the head kick. This is a kid at flyweight with a lot of potential. That being said, he has not beat a fighter with a winning record. I believe with the three opponents he's beaten, only one of them has a victory. So him and a female Anim weight named Reina Kubota, those are the two fighters that you can tell Ryzen is very high on in terms of their charisma and ability to get wins. But Jason, overall, I would say thumbs in the middle. But I'm very excited about Ryzen moving forward.
In terms of rest of MMA to mention, on Saturday on Flow Combat, you had Valor Fights 42 and CES MMA 43 over the Valor card. Stephen Haig got a submission win in the first round against Quentin Culpepper. Lindsey Jones got a TKO win in the first round against Jeff Powell. You may remember Lindsey from his win over Kate Cash. He's now 2-0 and got the nickname at ATT as a Sweet Tea. Because the origin of that nickname is after he won his fight against K Cash, he's at home and he comes back down to the ATT and they're like, "So what'd you do?" And he's like, "Oh, I was just at home drinking some sweet tea." And they're like, "Well, sweet tea's now your nickname." So that's someone to pay attention to. Also, Cole Farrell, another guy to pay attention to in Valor Fights. He got a submission win over Bruce Duckett. CES MMA 43, Pedro Gonzalez gets a submission win in the first round over Bruno Jacare Diaz. There was a little bit of a controversy there, but Pedro Gonzalez improves to 12-5. Someone to pay attention to on that, on the regional scene there, potentially. Could be a guy that maybe we see in the UFC at some point. Rico Daskula bounces back. He gets a decision win over Matt Lozano in the co-main event. And a fighter to pay attention to that's up there, Mike Rodriguez. He got another win. He has competed at 185 and 205. He's now won back-to-back fights after losing to Kevin Haley at the end of last year. That's a guy to pay attention to there. So there was a ton of MMA going on. Of course, another busy weekend of MMA coming up here this week as you've got both Bellator and the UFC cards taking place this weekend. Of course, we'll have a preview show. Look for that on Friday morning. And, of course, I will be calling Battleground MMA with Dustin Poirier on Friday night live on Fight TV for $19.99. As I mentioned, if you are within 72 miles of Tampa, Florida, that fight car will be blacked out. But if you're outside of the Tampa Bay region, you can watch myself and Dustin Poirier call those fights on Friday night. If you're in the Tampa area, the weigh-ins are on Thursday at 6 o'clock Eastern. Those will be streamed, I believe, on Fight TV. And, of course, I'll have some coverage of that as well coming up this week. So looking forward to that. So it's another busy week, Daniel.
Very exciting. Battleground, 5 days, 8 hours, 9 minutes, 16 seconds until April 21st. Starts at 6:30 Eastern. 6:30 Central, 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific. Check it out. Looking forward to it. I'm sure you'll do great, you and Poirier. Should be fun times, dude.
Yeah, I'll say this. Also, Victory FC took place on Friday. One of the things I love about Victory, what they do in their pre-fight graphics for a fight comes up, they tell you what the fighter weighed in on weigh-in day and what he's weighing that day. Can we get more organizations to do that?
Yeah, that would be great. On that card, Rob Emerson lost the championship fight against a prospect to keep an eye on.
Rafael Stouts,
he won that one. And then the other fighter I would mention, I think the regional fighter that stole the weekend had to have been Sabina Mazo. I believe she's a strawweight. I could be wrong there, but she had a brutal head kick knockout over Jamie Thornton. That if you have not seen it, look it up. It was the Colombian Queen is her name. She's 20 years old. She is a flyweight, and she's 3-0 now. Keep an eye out for her.
Yeah, just a brutal knockout. You can actually see that knockout on the Access TV YouTube page. So that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the MMA Report post-fight podcast. Myself and Daniel will be back on Friday for the MMA Report pre-fight show as we're going to preview UFC Fight Night Nashville, also Bellator 178. On Wednesday, I will have a new episode of the MMA Report podcast. Joining me on this week's podcast, I've got Tyrell Fortune, Syed Awad are on that fight card, plus going to be talking to several of the fighters that are going to be on that Battleground show that I'm calling here in Tampa. So be sure to follow Daniel on Twitter at Daniel Galvan DGG. Follow myself on Twitter at Jason_Floyd. Be sure to like the MMA Report on Facebook, facebook.com/the MMA Report. Also, be sure to check out all the podcasts offered on radioinfluence.com.
This is an Ian Beckles Flavor in Your Ear quick fix on Radio Influence.
Jerry Jones is trying to get the NFL to ease up on the marijuana laws. It's about time now, people, just in general. Let me tell you how the marijuana laws work in the league. A lot of people don't really understand how it works. A lot of people, the funny part is, I didn't understand how it worked while I played. I understand now. This is what I played. It's a little different now, I believe. You know you're going to get drug tested in July during training camp. So training camp usually started the last week of July, so July 25th, something like that. So you know that the first day or second day of training camp, so July 26th, you're going to get drug tested by the NFL. You knew this. You don't get drug tested the whole offseason. You know July 26th, you're going to get drug tested. Therefore, June 26th, you stop smoking. Now, I'm going to preface it by saying this. I didn't smoke it at that time. I didn't say I'm not smoking it now, but I didn't smoke it at that time. I was scared of, just the stress of the whole thing. So I would watch everybody around me with a month left stop smoking and taking what you got to clear your system out. The day they do the drug tests on July 26th during training camp, that night, everybody is high as giraffe pussy because they haven't been high for a month. Fact. And the rest of the season, they can smoke every day, all day. So what is that doing? If you're just stopping people from smoking for 1 month, it's not doing anything whatsoever.
You can find Ian Beckles' Flavor in Your Ear on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.